Bridget Grant and Kane had seen generators of that type before in various and unlikely places around the world. Lakesh had put forth the initial speculation they were fusion reactors, the energy output held in a delicately balanced magnetic matrix. When the matrix was breached, an explosion of apocalyptic proportions resulted, which was what caused the destruction of the Dulce installation.
So even if the generator blows up, it won't initiate the process? We'll get a big-ass fireball, but we won't have jump-started the entropic process?
Filboid nodded, but his expression was doubtful.
I don't know. It sounds reasonable, but this is completely off the wall. Total speculation on an unprecedented event.
The particle accelerator is the key component. But how do you figure to knock anything out? I mean, the platform is way up there, and we're way down here.
Grant surveyed the three scientists with intent eyes.
I plan to get way up there from way down here. Earlier today, I saw a TAV make a run on the Citadel. It was chased off by one of the craft in there. I'm assuming one of McCann's boys flew that ship. Who piloted the other one?
He nodded toward the door and the hangar beyond.
Furies, probably. Ever since McCann occupied this part of the Citadel acreage, they make flyovers.
And Furies are the ones who made us crash your flitter gig, Phil Boyd. Does anybody know if McCann's crates are aerospace planes like the TAVs? They look pretty old to me.
I would imagine they'd have the same capabilities as the TAV. I got a look at them when they brought me in. In my estimation, they're the prototype for the TAV.
Grant nodded approvingly.
I had the same impression. Good.
You don't really think you can steal a flyer and shoot down the Devil platform?
I sure as hell intend to try, but not shoot it down. My target will be the generator.
What makes you so certain you can pilot one of those old ships? I mean, you told me back at the mine you could fly choppers, but...
If those Manta ships are the prototypes for the TAVs, then they ought to be fairly simple to jockey.
Grant, that's an awfully chancy ought to be to risk your life on.
He nodded in acceptance of her opinion.
I really don't see that we have many options available to us. We do nothing, and in 10 hours we age a billion years inside of a second, or I try to keep that from happening. Or die trying, anyway.
Kane's teeth flashed in the semi-gloom of the chamber.
I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm excited about this plan.
Don't be. The platform has a self-defense system. It can generate and launch plasmoids of varying size, range, and power.
How about explaining what a plasmoid is for the technologically challenged in the class? What kind of power are we talking about?
Electrical, magnetic, mechanical, and thermal. Especially thermal. If you take a quantity of gas and heat it to a point where the atomic particles begin to disassociate and the substance ionizes...
Philboyd's words trailed off, and he shrugged as if he had already explained everything.
Heat it to what kind of temperature? How hot?
Oh, 10,000 degrees or so. Plasmoids can be as cool as 7,000 degrees, but there's really no upper limit short of mass energy conversion, which only happens inside stars. So to answer your question, 10,000 degrees Celsius.
Celsius?
Centigrade. The ionized gas is probably released with a spin on it, what we called body English.
Who is we?
Those of us born before the nuke cost. Anyway, a moving electrical charge generates a magnetic field that's temporarily self-sustaining. Surface turbulence tends to prevent the heat escaping, and its own field holds it together until something stops its motion.
Something like a population center?
Any kind of something. Then the plasmoid releases whatever volume of superheated electrically charged gas makes it up. If it was the size of a pinhead, it wouldn't last very long, and probably wouldn't even burn a hole in cloth.
What's the range of this thing?
That depends on the speed of its launch.
So its destructive capability depends on speed and size?
Philboyd shook his head.
Not necessarily the size. A larger plasmoid wouldn't be powerful. Its destructive capacity is governed by the amount of energy stored within it. Temperature, electrical change, turbulence. All those factors are more important than size.
He flicked his eyes up and down Grant's frame.
We pre-darkers learned that size isn't everything.
What about speed?
Plasmoids usually have a peak velocity in the neighborhood of 500 feet per second.
That's not really very fast. The muzzle velocity of our hand blasters is considerably higher.
Philboyd smirked.
It's still a little too fast to outrun or to duck.
I guess I'll find out the hard way the speed of the Manta ships.
Kane smiled wryly.
You wouldn't have it any other way.
His smile vanished as he addressed everyone.
In a few minutes, McCann or Saladin will troop in here to take Baptiste out to deliver the message to Enki. All of us need to be alert, to watch for our chance, to make a break for it, and cover for Grant.
Cleve suddenly seemed to have trouble speaking and swallowing.
Some of us might be killed. All of us might be killed.
At least you won't be dying of old age, but that will happen in about 10 hours anyway. If I'm going out, I'd prefer to do so while I can still make a fairly passable corpse.
Nobody laughed, but Kane hadn't really expected them to. If there was one thing Erica Van Sloan missed about the chaotic, anarchic 20th century, it was cigarettes. The nuclear holocaust had pretty much completed what government legislation had begun in regards to tobacco, since it was no longer cultivated as a crop. What now sprang from the irradiated soil of the old Carolinas would probably have a far more deleterious effect than all the secondhand smoke in history. Hardly anyone but outlanders used tobacco in any form any longer. There were mild drugs available that were much safer, less offensive to others, and just as sedative. Smoking was certainly forbidden in all the administrative monoliths and the residential enclaves of the baronies. Sloane knew some enterprising souls grew hidden fields of it somewhere, but she seriously doubted they were anywhere within walking distance of the Shan province of China. A cigarette, preferably mentholated, would make waiting for an audience with the Imperator much easier to bear. She was in an agony of nervous impatience, but she did her best to appear composed before the Imperial guards patrolling the perimeter of the pyramid. She watched them through the dark lenses of her sunglasses and wondered briefly if they were watching her through the tinted full-face visors of their helmets. They wore high black boots, ebony leggings, and tailored tunics. Emblazoned on the left sleeve was a familiar symbol, a red, thick-walled pyramid partially bisected by three elongated but reversed triangles. Small discs topped each triangle, lending them a resemblance to round-hilted daggers. The guards cradled wicked-looking SIG AMT submachine guns in their arms. They seemed to pay more attention to the weapons than to her, and for a moment she felt an irrational surge of jealousy. Erica Van Sloan was tall and beautiful, with a flawless complexion the hue of fine honey. Her long, straight hair, swept back from a high forehead and pronounced widow's peak, tumbled artlessly about her shoulders. It was so black as to be blue when the light caught it, except for the wide strip of gray running like a bleached-out ribbon through the left side of her tresses. The large feline-slanted eyes, above high regal cheekbones, swam with glints of violet. The mark of an aristocrat showed in her delicate features, with the arch of brows and her thin-bridged nose. A graceful swan-like neck led to a slender body encased all in black. High-heeled black boots, jodhpurs of a shiny black fabric, with an ebony satin tunic tailored to conform to the thrust of her full breasts. Her left sleeve bore the same insignia as the guards. Once, it had served as the unifying emblem of the Archon Directorate, as well as over Project Excalibur, the Totality Concepts division devoted to genetic engineering. Now it was the insignia of the Imperator. At the sound of churning veins in the distance, Sloane lifted her gaze, watching the Deathbird flying over the grass-covered ridges and hills. Painted a matte, non-reflective black, the helicopter's sleek, streamlined contours were interrupted by only the two ventral stub wings. Each wing carried a pod of 16 57mm missiles. The pair of T-700-701 turboshaft engines was equipped with noise baffles, so only the sound of the steel blades slicing through the air was audible. The Deathbirds were modified AH-64 Apache attack gunships, and most of the fleet had been re-engineered and retrofitted dozens of times. The forepart of the black chopper was tinted a smoky hue, so the pilot and the gunner were nearly invisible. Sloane had often wondered where Sam had found the machines, whether he had looted a vill of its fleet or found another source, but she never put the question to him, just as she had never asked too many penetrating questions about his choice of headquarters. After all, China was very, very far away from the network of vills and the governing body of barons. The brow of a grassy hill overlooked a thickly wooded valley roughly a mile across. A river flowed through the valley, the foaming blue waters cascading down a gentle fall to the west. Dominating the entire valley was the vast pyramidal structure that shouldered the blue sky. It was composed of countless fitted blocks of stone, the top quarried perfectly flat. Bright sunlight played along the white facade of the monstrous monolith. Standing at its base, Sloane could see only a small portion of its staggering proportions. Before the Nukost, the existence of the Great Pyramid of China was repeatedly denied by the communist government. Archaeologists believed it to have been part of the tomb of Emperor Shi Hunangti. Sam had told her the immense structure had originally been painted black on the north side, blue-gray on the east, red on the south, and white on the west. The apex was painted yellow. The significance of the colors apparently had to do with the Taoist system of the five phases of existence. Sloane didn't know how much to believe, but she never had reason to doubt Sam's words before. Until yesterday. Almost unconsciously, she touched the strip of gray in her hair. She knew it was foolish to allow what amounted to vanity to upset her so intensely. She also didn't like feeling suspicious of Sam. After what he had done for her, for the entire inefficient Vil network, and what he planned for the entire world, the emotion made her feel ashamed. She looked again at the bucolic majesty of the Shan Valley. Like the rest of humanity, she had taken the permanence of the earth for granted. Then, on January 20th, 2001, mountains walked, plains became inland seas, earthquakes and tidal waves re-sculpted coastal regions, and billions died. For the following generations, nothing was permanent, especially dreams of love, security, and a future. Sloane was one of the lucky ones, or so she had been told. Like many other scientists and military officers attached to the totality concept, she sat out the nuclear exchange and the Skydark in the Anthill Complex, the most ambitious continuity of government installation ever built. Over a period of years, everyone living in the Anthill was turned into a cyborg, a hybridization of human and machine. Since the main difficulty in constructing interfaces between mechanical, electric, and organic systems was the wiring, Sloane oversaw the implantation of squids directly into the brain. The superconducting quantum interface devices, 1/100th of a micron across, facilitated the subject's control over his or her new prostheses. Of course, the transformations didn't solve all of the Anthill's survival issues. Compensation for the natural aging process of organs and tissues had to be taken into account. The Anthill personnel needed a supply of fresh organs, preferably those of young people, but obviously the supply was severely limited. So a solution was sought. Cryogenics, or a variation thereof. The form of cryogenesis employed at the installation wasn't the standard freezing process relying on immersing a subject in liquid nitrogen and the removal of blood and organs. It utilized a technology that employed a stasis screen tied in with the electrostatic sterilizing fields, which for all intents and purposes turned the Anthill complex into an encapsulated deep storage vault. This process created a form of active suspended animation, almost as if the personnel were enclosed by an impenetrable bubble of space and time, slowing to a crawl all metabolic processes. The people achieved a form of immortality, but one completely dependent on technology. However, even those measures were temporary. Sloane volunteered to enter a stasis canister for a period of time, to be resurrected at some future date when the sun shone again and the world was secure. When Sloane awakened, more than 122 years had passed. During her long slumber, the Anthill installation suffered near-catastrophic damage, and a number of stasis units malfunctioned. Her canister was one of those. Due to that malfunction, her squid's interface had inflicted neurological damage on her body. She was resurrected as a cripple, her long, shapely legs little more than withered, atrophied sticks. Sam had not only restored her youth, but he had also put life back in her legs again. He also gave her purpose beyond acting as advisor to the baronial oligarchy. She dedicated her life to building a new, productive society on the framework of the Vil system. Since cybernetic principles were applied to management and organizational theory, she always had much to offer in the way of streamlining Vil government. Just as everything that occurred in the universe could be analyzed into cause and effect chains, the chains themselves could be used to build organizational models. Now, months after the overthrow of Baron Cobalt, a new model was being constructed, and Sloane was using Cobaltville as the template. She threw herself into the task with an obsessive fixation that surprised even her. Her devotion sprang mainly from a sense of liberation. For more than 30 years following her revival from stasis, Sloane had spent almost every minute of it in artificial environments. Confined to a wheelchair, she rarely ventured outdoors and had lived for 3 decades without knowing the varied tang of natural air, without seeing or smelling the sea, or taking walks in the rain or the snow. She had been separated from everything she took for granted in her old life and hadn't realized how much she loved it until it was taken from her. Then Sam, her precious son, a mixture of her in vitro genetic material spliced with that of Enlil's, had given it back, or at least returned the promise of it. Erica's sexual energy had also been enhanced since Sam restored her youth. She often wondered if Lakesh experienced a similar phenomenon. She had toyed with the possibility that Sam had stimulated her metabolism in such a way that her endorphin level was unnaturally high, but she never thought to ask him about it. It wasn't seemly for a mother to ask her son a question of that nature. But now she intended to demand answers. Sloane had been preparing to engage in a ménage à trois with 2 of the baronial guardsmen in Cobaltville when, preening naked before a mirror, she saw the strip of gray in her hair. All erotic sensual inclinations had been subsumed by a sudden flood of wild panic. A vision of how she had looked only a few months before crowded into the forefront of her mind. She knew she would rather die than become a gnarled, paralyzed, and withered old crone again. Sloane wasted little time in reaching the secret gateway unit on level A of the admin monolith and keying in the destination lock codes for the Mattrans chamber in the Shan Pyramid. But since materializing within it, she had done nothing but wait, informed that the Imperator was otherwise engaged. She loitered outside, which at least gave her time to regain control of her emotions. She was no longer stricken with terror. She told herself over and over again that Sam would not allow her to age, that he would once more lay his hands on her and spread his youth-giving bioenergy through her body. A voice from behind her commanded her attention.
"Imperial Mother, the Lord Imperator will see you now."
Sloane turned, seeing a small Asian man in a black uniform at the square-cut doorway.
"Shall I escort the Imperial Mother to the Chamber of the Heart?"
"No, nor shall you or anyone here disturb me or my son there."
The man nodded deferentially and stepped aside as Sloane strode into the pyramid. She stalked purposefully down the passageway, taking long-legged strides, her boot heels clacking in a steady rhythm against the stone floor. She went through an open doorway and into the Hall of Memory, as Sam called it. As far as she was concerned, it was a museum, a central clearinghouse of several ancient cultures. A tall, round sandstone pillar bearing ornate carvings of birds and animal heads was bracketed by 2 large sculptures, one a feathered jaguar and the other a serpent with wings. Silken tapestries depicting Asian ideographs hung from the walls. There were other tapestries, all bearing twisting geometric designs. Suspended from the ceiling by thin steel wires was a huge gold disc in the form of the Rehorakhte falcon. The upcurving wings were inlaid with colored glass. The sun disk atop the beaked head was a cabochon-cut carnelian. Ceramic effigy jars and elegantly crafted vessels depicting animal-headed gods and goddesses from the Egyptian pantheon were stacked in neat pyramids. Arrayed on a long shelf on the opposite wall were a dozen small statuettes representing laborers in the land of the dead. Against the right wall was a granite 12-foot-tall replica of the seated figure of Ramses III. It towered over a cluster of dark basalt blocks inscribed with deep rune markings. A huge, gilt-framed mirror, at least 10 feet tall and 5 wide, stood amid stacks of weaponry, swords, shields, and lances. A spearhead with a single drop of blood on its nicked point rested on a table. The center and corners of the floor were crammed with exhibit after exhibit, artifacts from every possible time, every culture, Incan, Mayan, Chinese, Egyptian, and others Sloane could not begin to identify. But each and every item appeared to be in perfect condition. The huge room was an archaeologist's wet dream, but in reality, it was a sampling from every human culture ever influenced by the Tuatha De Danann, the Anunnaki, and the race known as Archons. Sloane went through the far door, and the passageway subtly changed. The floor became smoother, and the square-cut blocks of stone on the walls gave way to smooth, seamless expanses. They glittered dully, with inestimable flecks of all colors, providing a soft light. The rounded ceiling wound gently in an ever-widening curve. The floor, gleaming to the eye like oiled slate, gave a solid footing. The corridor suddenly opened into a vast, domed space. Sloane took off her sunglasses and swept her eyes around the natural cavern. The unfinished stone of its ceiling gleamed here and there with clusters of crystals and geodes. The floor dipped in a gentle incline, and at the center, surrounded by a collar of interlocking silver slabs, was a pool. The inner rim was lined with an edging of crystal points that glowed with a dull iridescence. At first glance, the pool took up the entire chamber floor, except for a walkway around it, about 5 feet wide. The pool was about 50 feet in total circumference, and light shimmered within it, but it was not water. Sam called it the heart of the earth, a nexus point of geomantic energy, a hub of earth energies. The surface of the pool pulsed with a ghostly phosphorescence, and by its glow, Sloane saw the tall, slender figure standing at the rim. He wore a robe of a saffron hue, and his features were hidden by a cowl. She rocked to an unsteady halt as mist began to swell out of the throat of the pool, bulging upward. A shimmering sphere, the diameter of the rim, slowly rose, like a hot air balloon made of a semi-transparent substance. Sloane could almost, but not quite, see through it. Her flesh prickled with a pins-and-needles sensation, as if she were standing near a low-level electrical field.
"This is an interesting, if minor, bit of synchronicity, Mother. Here I am, communing with the forces of the Earth, Mother, and you arrive for the first time in months."
Sloane saw how the crystals overhead pulsed with a purplish-black light that was beyond dark. The angle of tilt and the tuning of the facets against one another formed a balanced matrix, which drew out and suspended the energy globe. Sam had described the pool within the pyramid as a cardinal point in the world grid harmonics, a part of a network of pyramids built at key places around the world to tap the Earth's natural geomantic energies, what the Hindus called prana. But Sloane wasn't thinking about such esoterica. She gaped at Sam, astonished into speechlessness by his appearance. She knew his metabolism was geared to a far faster rate than a human's, or rather she had accepted that concept.
"Sam?"
"Mother, nice of you to visit at long last."
Sloane didn't answer for a long moment. She couldn't answer. The last time she had seen the boy, barely 3 months ago, he was the size of a 12-year-old. Now, judging by his height and the deepness of his voice, he had matured to the mid-teen years. And she sensed something else about him as well, some subtle quality that pimpled her flesh and set her heart to thudding frantically within her chest.
"There's been a change."
"Really? In you, me, or in Cobaltville?"
"In me."
She stepped closer to the pool, eyeing the bubble of mist floating above it. Images swam across its surface, or within it, but she could make no sense of them. Although his back was turned to her, Sloane touched the gray streak in her hair.
"I'm aging again. Regressing."
The hooded head nodded.
"That was to be expected, Mother. I can only turn back the hands of your biological clock so far before it begins keeping correct time again."
"Yes, but my concern is for my legs. What if I regress back to the state of only a few months ago? I'll be a cripple again, of no use to you or your program."
"That will not happen. The loss of your legs was due to neurological damage inflicted by your cybernetic implants. I repaired that. It can't be undone."
Sloane was not relieved by the nonchalant assurance. An awkward silence stretched between them. Sloane was dismayed and distressed by how distant, even dismissive, Sam seemed.
"Is that all?"
She lost what was left of her patience and her temper.
"No, it's not all."
She marched across the cavern to the rim of the well, reaching out to grab Sam's arm.
"Look at me when I'm talking to you, damn you!"
She tried to spin him to face her, but it was like attempting to twist a granite statue on its pedestal. Sloane was too consumed with anger to wonder about his immobility. She pushed herself between him and the floating orb of mist. Sam bowed his head and turned away, and Sloane heard a dry, harsh rustle beneath his robe, the light friction of scales against cloth. Sloane plucked at his sleeve.
Is something wrong? Are you sick? Let me look at you.
Sam paused, and his hooded head swiveled slightly toward her. Most of his face was cast in the shadow of the cowl, but she saw his eyes gleaming there like two chunks of ice. The breath seized in Sloane's lungs. The eyes were young, with an alien sort of youth that was not of the physical. In them glittered a cold wisdom, and a power that awakened the primitive in her heart. They were the eyes of a dragon, hungry and superior. She wanted to run, to hide away. Every cell in her body recoiled, every instinct blindly backed away in a xenophobic cringing.
Not yet, Mother. I have yet to make the change. When that happens, you may look at me.
Sloane realized he was manipulating the timbre and pitch so the vibrations would resonate sympathetically to the inner ear and stimulate the neuroenergy system.
Make the change to what?
I'm not sure yet of what I will be. A child of the hidden places, the perfect offspring of another great order of life, the living legacy of the Serpent Kings, the last of which enters into extinction this night.
Horror engulfed Sloane. In that first overwhelming shock of revulsion, she was hardly aware of Sam taking her hands and pressing them between both of his own. She glanced down and cried out. She had grown accustomed to the faint pattern of vestigial scales that had glistened dully between his fingers, but the delicate coating of scales had spread across the backs of his hands. Pearly nails tipped his fingers, and they might have been pretty if they hadn't curved downward like claws.
Anunnaki? You're changing into one of them?
Something far greater. Remember what I once told you? That hybrids take on all the positive attributes of their parents, becoming the most exceptional specimens?
Sloane closed her mouth on a scream. She squeezed her eyes shut, not wanting to even glimpse the face that might be leering at her from beneath the cowl.
I will not know exactly how exceptional until my change is complete. Then you will either take pride in the blood that runs through your halving, or disown me as a changeling.
Sam paused, and his grip tightened around her hands. His fingers were as strong and as cold as tempered steel.
Oh.
Sloane cried out in pain, but she didn't try to struggle.
And you come to me because of a trivial cosmetic matter. You are vain, Mother, and I have no sympathy for such a flaw. Here is the truth behind your restoration. You have failed me. I charged you with the task of enlisting Mohandas Lakesh Singh to my cause. Instead, you squandered the youth I restored to you by glutting yourself on physical passions and flaunting your power in Koboldville. I expected you to only succeed Baron Kobold, not replace him with your own vainglorious ego. The gift of youth and the gift of power were always intended to be transitory. You enjoyed both only at my whim. And as you are now in terror of losing those gifts, the man Singh is also aware of the temporary nature of his restoration. If he experiences only a fraction of your own horror, then he shall be easy to recruit. When you bring him to me, I shall, as in the Sumerian tale of Gilgamesh, return you to the condition of your youth.
Sloane's mind seemed as trapped as her hands. It could not think or speculate, pressed between the heavy weights of fear and desperation. She strained for breath, her lips parting. Suddenly, Sam set his own lips against her. They were dry and rough, as if they were chafed from long exposure to cold winds. There was no love, no tenderness in the kiss. It was a gesture of contempt. Then he released her, thrusting her from him. He heeled away from her.
Do as I bid, Mother.
His parting whisper was as sibilant as the hissing of a serpent.
Remember, if you fail me, you fail yourself.
Fear, like love, took time to develop, and Brigid Baptiste's compulsively ordered mind was in danger of being consumed by utter terror. The prospect of Saladin or McCann marching in and shoving Majira's severed head into her arms didn't disquiet her particularly. It was the waiting for whatever was going to happen that dried up all the moisture in her mouth, made her heart triphammer, and twisted her stomach into acidic knots. Her memory kept flitting back to the day, nearly 2 years ago now, when she waited naked in a bare-walled cell to be brought before Baron Cobalt's tribunal. She was certain she would die that day. She had no problem recollecting the terror she had felt, the almost suffocating sense of doom. She'd had no plan except to die without shaming herself. To weep and beg for mercy would not have accomplished anything or delayed the inevitable. Bridget cast a glance across the room at Kane and Grant, envying their studied ease as they lounged against the curving consoles, speaking to Cleve about the location of weapons and EVA suits. Judging by their relaxed postures, they didn't anticipate anything more taxing than eating a hearty dinner. She supposed both men had been through so many harrowing experiences, as magistrates and after, that life-threatening situations no longer upset their emotional equilibrium. But she knew her assessment was a false one, despite the fact that they were hardened veterans of dozens of violent incidents. They had been raised to be killers, after all, to kill anything or anyone that threatened the security of Baron Cobalt. She surreptitiously looked at Grant, who at that moment was stifling a yawn. Grant, like Kane, had been through the dehumanizing cruelty of magistrate training, yet they had somehow almost miraculously managed to retain their humanity. But vestiges of their mag years still lurked close to the surface, particularly in Grant. He presented a dour, closed, and private persona, rarely showing emotion. He was taciturn and slow to genuine anger, but when he was provoked, his destructive ruthlessness could be terrifying. And though he didn't yet show it, she knew he was very provoked. Nora, Phil Boyd, and Cleve, on the other hand, showed their emotional states by pacing restlessly, going to the door, pressing their ears against it, then pacing again. More than once, they bumped into one another as they circled the puddle of blood on the deck, now tacky and congealed. Cleve approached Grant hesitantly.
Presuming any of us get out of this...
Nobody's given up yet.
Cleve nodded.
In that case, allow me to apologize for kicking you while you were helpless. It was the act of a coward, of a bounder, and I can only offer a reason, not an excuse.
Grant angled an eyebrow at him.
Which is?
Cleve gingerly touched his bandaged head.
One of Saladin's men bashed me around yesterday, because Janish had left the area without permission. He asked me where he went, and he didn't care for my answer, which consisted of two words, and he whacked me with his rifle.
Grant nodded gravely.
I believe your friend is dead. He saved me from a Carnabot, but he'd already been tagged by a Fury.
He jerked a thumb toward Majira's head.
She came along and completed the job.
Cleve swallowed hard.
I was afraid of that.
Nora sighed sadly.
Oh, so many of us dead now. I hope Eduardo, Newkirk, and Mariah are still alive.
Phil Boyd nodded.
Me too. We always manage to stick together.
Kane shifted position.
If they're still alive when this is done, I expect all of you to come back to Earth with us.
It's not a radioactive cinder?
Parts of it are. Some parts aren't. But it's sure as hell better than here.
Phil Boyd threw him a bleak grin.
That wouldn't be too much of a stretch.
Nora sighed again, running her hands through her tangled mass of hair, then pursing her lips in disgust.
I haven't had a decent shampoo in a year or more. I certainly hope there's still some available where you're from.
Bridget decided to join in the conversation, if nothing else but to divert her attention from fearsome memories.
There's plenty of it in storage, enough to last a lifetime.
Nora's eyes flickered with interest.
Really? What about cosmetics?
Bridget nodded.
Those too. Plenty of everything you'd ever want or need.
Oh, for God's sake. With what's facing us in the next few hours, I think our time is better spent discussing tactics, not lip gloss or panty shields.
Everyone fell silent. Kane presented the image of pondering a problem for a thoughtful second.
Anyhow, some of that mascara in storage has turned to cement over the past couple of years. But you can mix water with it, stick it in the microwave, and make it as good as new.
How the hell would you know that?
Kane grinned.
To be honest, I saw DeFore doing it a couple of months ago. That's all there was to it.
I'll bet.
Bridget flashed him a sly smile to let him know she meant no offense. For a long time, at the beginning of their relationship, it was very difficult for Kane and Bridget not to give offense to each other. Both people had their individual gifts. Most of what was important to people in the post-nuke world came easily to Kane. Survival skills, prevailing in the face of adversity, and cunning against enemies. But he could also be reckless, high-strung to the point of instability, and given to fits of rage. Bridget, on the other hand, was structured and ordered, with a brilliant analytical mind. However, her clinical nature, the cool scientific detachment upon which she prided herself, sometimes blocked an understanding of the obvious human factor in any given situation. Regardless of their contrasting personalities, Kane and Bridget worked very well as a team, playing on each other's strengths rather than compounding their individual weaknesses. It had taken her several months to grudgingly admit she learned a great deal from Kane and from her association with Grant and Domi. She had learned to accept risk as a part of her way of life, taking chances so that others might find the ground beneath their feet a little more secure. She didn't consider her attitude idealism, but simple pragmatism. If she had learned anything from her friends, it was to regard death as a part of the challenge of existence, a fact that every man and woman must face eventually. She could accept it without humiliating herself if it came as a result of her efforts to remove the yokes of the barons from the collective neck of humanity. Although she never spoke of it, certainly not to the cynical Kane, she had privately vowed to make the future a better, cleaner place than either the past or the present. She suspected he knew anyway. Cleve stroked his beard contemplatively.
You seem to know a great deal about the Anunnaki and the Tuatha De Danann.
Bridget shrugged.
Mainly the old legends. But we've come across sufficient evidence over the past couple of years to prove, at least to me, that the myths had a strong foundation in reality. The secret history of humanity.
Nora smiled lopsidedly.
I can't say it does anything for my ego to know that the human race was genetically engineered by a bunch of scaly aliens to be manual laborers.
Bridget returned her smile, feeling some of her fear ebbing away.
That's only one part of the story. Evidence of alternate biospheres for unknown aspects of the one in which humanity lived has been part and parcel of mythology since the dawn of history. For example, the legend of Cadmus tells of a battle with a dragon that rose out of the earth. He killed it and buried its teeth in the soil. From the planted teeth grew a host of armed warriors who fought one another until all but five were dead. These men served Cadmus and helped build the city of Thebes. From these five dragon-born were descended the five noblest families of Thebes, families who ultimately were descended from the dragon. The symbolism is obvious, representing a link between the human and non-human. Ancient Chinese mythology gives us the tale of the dragon husband, where the dragon took the youngest daughter from a farmer. Here, the girl witnessed the Dragon King dancing with delight, curling like a ribbon or a DNA helix, and transforming into a human being. These are universal motifs, occurring regardless of race, culture, or location. The UFO abduction scenario of the 20th century was just a new mask for an old player, a new cover story for forces that have plagued and deceived humanity for thousands of years.
Philboyd nodded.
I can handle the idea that the Anunnaki contributed to human cultures, but it's the notion they created the very concept of gods that I don't care for.
So you're a religious man?
Philboyd shrugged.
Tough for a scientist to admit, but yeah, I tried to be. So it's unsettling to think we deified a bunch of extraterrestrials who viewed us as slave labor.
I think they looked at us as more than that. At some point, the Anunnaki reached the conclusion that they needed intermediaries between themselves and the masses of humanity. As a bridge between themselves as the gods and humankind, they introduced the concept of the God-King on Earth, appointing human rulers who would assure humanity's service to the gods and channel their teachings and laws to the people. Therefore, the Anunnaki chose to create a new dynasty of rulers known as demigods or god-kings because of their exalted bloodlines. That situation has been revived now on Earth through the baronies.
Cleve's eyes widened. He looked toward Kane,
And you say Earth is better than here?
Our 30 acres of it is. But after this is all over, you're welcome to stay here and provide fuel for the Carnobots if you want.
Thulboid laughed, quickly stifled when Cleve shot a glare in his direction. He opened his mouth to say something else. He closed it almost immediately when the lock solenoids on the door snapped open loudly. The door rumbled aside, taking so long to slide into its double-walled slot that Kane wondered if it were malfunctioning. Distantly, he understood his time perceptions were distorted by tension, slowing everything to a crawl. It was the mind's perfidious way of postponing a horrific inevitable. Recognizing the symptoms of stress, he began taking deep, regular breaths, forcing himself to relax. He stood and gazed at the door, noting that Grant hadn't stirred from his sitting position on the curving console. At the periphery of his vision, he saw Bridget starting to rise to her feet, but he gestured to her, indicating she should stay where she was. Let them come to her, he told himself grimly. The door opened all the way. Kane's belly turned a cold flip-flop when he saw McCann standing framed in the portal, eerily backlit by the lights of the hangar. Saladin stood on the catwalk behind him, hefting his plasma rifle. Extending a lean, muscled arm, McCann pointed to Philboyd, then to Majira's head against the far bulkhead. He swung his arm toward Bridget and beckoned to her with a forefinger. Before she stood, Kane stepped forward.
McCann?
As you were.
Kane ignored the command.
We know what you have planned, even if we aren't sure why. But there's one thing I am sure of. If you detonate Devil, you'll be obliterating people on Earth who still carry the Tuatha De Danann bloodline.
McCann smiled mockingly.
That's rather the point, isn't it?
His soft voice had in it the bite of contempt, and Kane felt sweat form at his hairline. McCann's casual revelation set the blood to thundering in his ears. Philboyd retrieved Majira's head and shuffled forward, holding it between two hands as if it were plutonium. He did his desperate best not to look at it. McCann gestured imperiously to Bridget again. Slowly she stood, face composed. Kane sidestepped in front of her, putting himself between her and McCann.
I don't know what made you so crazy with hate, but if you're hell-bent on suicide, why don't you just take a long walk outside without a spacesuit? You'd save everybody a lot of time and trouble.
McCann stood very still, regarding Kane dispassionately.
You are an arrogant one, aren't you? Don't you know I could kill you where you stand?
Kane showed the edges of his teeth in a humorless, wolfish grin.
You're welcome to try, Peter Pan.
He watched his eyes, alert for a color change.
You seek to provoke me, and thus distract me with this empty posturing. That's all you humans could do. Posture, strut, proclaim. Once your kind venerated us, then you loathed and scorned us.
Yeah, so I've heard. But there was probably a good reason for that. What did you want from us?
We required only a modicum of obedience and respect, yet you hated and cursed us in the end.
Yesterday's news.
Kane was aware that Grant was carefully shifting position, watching for an opening.
Humanity would welcome you now.
Your repentance comes too late. Now stand aside.
Kane shook his head.
No.
No?
You heard me.
Oh, I heard you. I just couldn't believe my ears.
McCann's eyes suddenly flared with yellow fire, as if the interior of his skull were blazing with flames and his eye sockets only apertures into the inferno. The sudden psionic assault jolted Kane so hard he doubled over. The shock was so unexpected, so terrible, he nearly collapsed. Time, space, the universe darkened and turned. His surroundings shattered into a kaleidoscope of flying fragments. He drifted among them, and the sudden terror of it dragged up a scream from his throat. He clamped his jaws shut on it. A rush of unbridled emotion swept over him, nauseated him. For a shaved sliver of an instant, he felt what McCann felt, and it was terrible. Life was eternal agony without purpose, and he was weary of living it. Life, memory, emotion, all were torments. He wanted only to sink beneath the waves of peace, as gentle as drowning in a sea of oblivion. He craved non-existence as he had craved nothing else in his exceptionally long life. It seemed Kane heard voices, very faint, thready whispers that skittered along the edge of his consciousness. Grayed images penetrated his mind, and he felt his own mind merge with them. Layers of thoughts, of recollections about an unknown people, plucked at his mind, and he glimpsed the pictures and emotions and textures of thousands of years of existence. He could make no sense of them. It was all flying fragments of remembrances and experiences. It was as though he were tumbling headlong down a black tunnel, buildings, green fields, and faces flashing by in kaleidoscopic images. He plunged through a thousand memories so fast he couldn't comprehend any one of them. Then it was over, and Kane found himself on his hands and knees, making noises like a dog trying to dislodge a bone from his throat. He was only dimly aware of Bridget Baptiste kneeling at his side, attending to him.
What did you do to him?
A man is born in one world, and there he belongs. But my world is dead. Age and death came at last to everything there. I cannot live with the dreams of my world haunting me at every step. I would be rid of this life, as it would be rid of me, as of lifting, then lowering a veil. That is what I did to your insolent friend. I lifted the veil.
You're insane.
More than likely.
He reached down and closed a hand over Bridget's shoulder. She didn't resist when McCann pulled her to her feet. The orange glow of his eyes faded to little more than embers. Kane staggered erect, wiping at the clammy film of sweat on his face.
I trust I have made my point?
Kane was too numb to answer, and McCann smiled at him patronizingly, almost fondly.
You are a brave man, I'll give you that. Courage was the quality of your race I most admired, but here it will do you no good.
He beckoned to Filboid.
You, with her.
Filboid's eyes blinked spastically behind the lenses of his glasses.
Why me?
McCann's scarred face contorted in a macabre grin.
Why you, indeed? A very existential question. Perhaps you will find an answer to it in the hours to come.
Kane stepped forward, extending a hand to Bridget. She took it briefly, but McCann pulled her away, so it was more of a swift parting caress.
Anamkara.
It was the name they had for each other, learned during the op to Ireland long ago, but only rarely used. The old Gaelic term meant soul friend. At her whisper, McCann regarded her with startled eyes, and then an ironic smile tugged at the corners of his mouth.
The language of the Gaels, the tongue of the betrayers. I haven't heard it spoken in a very long time.
His smile became a savage writhing of the lips, and his eyes flamed up again, more red than orange. He covered her mouth with a hand, his inhumanly long fingers reaching out to almost encompass the entire lower portion of her face, thumb and forefinger nearly meeting at her nape.
And I will never hear it spoken in my presence again. Do you understand?
Kane took a quick half-step forward and delivered a lightning-fast double hammer blow to the small of McCann's back, right over the kidneys, or where a human's kidneys would be located. McCann stiffened, throwing his head back and voicing a gargling cry of surprised agony. Kane felt a surge of satisfaction at the sound. The man could be hurt, and if he could be hurt, he could be beaten. McCann moved. He was so fast, to Kane's eyes it was as if he had transmogrified into a multicolored blur. Kane felt a rush of air on his cheeks. Then he hit the deck flat on his back, impact knocking his breath out through his nostrils and mouth. He lay where he had fallen, in the drying puddle of blood, trying to cough, trying to breathe, trying to move. Kane's mouth filled with the salty tang of blood as a deep, boring pain settled in the center of his chest. He managed to hike himself up to his elbows as Filboid, McCann, and Bridget went through the door. The door panel rumbled shut, but not before Kane caught a final glimpse of Bridget's stricken face, eyes gleaming with fear out of a face drained of all color. Nora, Cleve, and Grant clustered around Kane, helping him to his feet, lifting him clear of the blood puddle.
Well, I won't win any good judgment points for that last decision.
He weaved unsteadily and leaned over a console, using his tongue to carefully probe the laceration on the tender lining of his cheek. Nora's face was a mask of anxiety.
Are you sure you're all right?
He moved so fucking fast.
Kane turned his head and spit a jet of scarlet into the pool of Majira's blood.
Very fucking fast.
What did he do to you before when his eyes changed color?
Slowly, Kane pushed himself away from the instrument panel. He touched his forehead.
A psionic attack. Or a communication. I don't really know which. But I know one damn thing. He's been waiting at least 3,000 years for a final judgment that was never levied. So he's arranging it for himself.
He would be rid of this life as it would be of him.
Cleve sat down heavily on the display boards, burying his face in his hands.
Oh, my God. All of it is over. All of it.
Kane winced as he straightened, squaring his shoulders.
Not quite. Survival first.
Grant squinted at him curiously.
Then what? Then, revenge.
Bridget and Philboyd followed McCann down the steps and into the cavern. She felt a creeping numbness in her arms and legs and a queasiness in the pit of her stomach. It was fear, but she looked around with her usual air of calm, if for nothing else but to provide an emotional anchor for Philboyd. He shuffled along beside her, clutching Majira's head. His complexion was waxy, and his quivering ashen lips made him look like a drowned corpse. None of Saladin's people came with them, but McCann kept his back to the two people, walking with a peculiar grace that was almost a swagger. He was confident they wouldn't dare attack him from behind, certainly not after they saw how easily he had swatted Kane aside. McCann followed the same route she and Kane had been forced to walk after they were captured. They skirted the noisome sewage drain and a bare-walled, well-lighted corridor. The floor was a raised disc of a translucent plastic-like substance about 4 feet in diameter. From beneath it emanated the faintest susurrus of electronic hums. A vertical shaft, the same size as the disc, extended up into shadows. Their vision couldn't penetrate the distance and darkness. McCann stepped aside and gestured for Philboyd and Bridget to step onto the disc.
You remember the message you are to convey?
Bridget only nodded. Her eidetic memory would never allow her to forget it, no matter how hard she tried.
When the lift stops, you will relay the message to any you might meet. Once you do, they will not hinder you.
Bridget narrowed her eyes in suspicion.
Who are you talking about?
McCann smiled.
Those called Furies, most likely. There are a handful who act as Enki's attendants and bodyguards. They take care of him.
Do you have him trapped up there?
The blurred image of Enki, transmitted by the remote vid probe, was what had triggered the mission to the moon in the first place.
No, he's not trapped at all. He chooses to sequester himself there. But he has ways to come and go as he pleases, but always he returns to wait.
Philboyd's fingers were hooked into Majira's hair.
Why haven't you just killed him then? Your faction is well armed and probably outnumbers the Furies.
McCann shook his head in pity, as if a mentally challenged child had asked him why the sky was blue.
Whatever gave you the idea I want to kill him? I want him dead, true enough, but that's not the same thing as killing him, is it?
He started to turn away, then stopped.
Oh, I almost forgot in all the preparations.
From the sash about his lean waist, he pulled the combat knife and presented it pommel first to Bridget. The dark blade was sticky with Majira's blood. She looked at it impassively, but made no move to accept it.
You want him dead, but you want me to kill him with a knife?
McCann tossed his hair back and laughed. The shivery, sobbing sound did not warm the blood.
Of course not. This is for you and your companion.
What?
There is a possibility that your minds will become so unhinged before the terms of the pact are fulfilled that you may wish to end the strain. I do not trust you with firearms. Therefore, I offer you the most expeditious means to free yourselves. A bit crude and messy, I cannot deny, but it's not as if anyone will have to clean up after you.
Bridget hesitated, then took the knife, surreptitiously eyeing the carotid artery in the slender column of McCann's neck. The idea of slashing his throat was only a fleeting impulse, but McCann's eyes suddenly darkened, as if thunderheads skimmed across a clear sky. Bridget let the big knife dangle at the end of her arm, and the Danann nodded approvingly.
Very wise.
Wise enough to know you can't get the drop on a telepath.
I'm not a telepath, not really.
He cast her a self-deprecating smile.
A number of my people were quite adept in the art of mind manipulation. The human mind was childishly easy to trick, feeding it illusions of invisibility and shape-shifting. Like anything else, it was a learned skill and required much time and concentration. I found the effort was beyond my interest in the subject.
Bridget did not try to soften her sarcasm.
You preferred to hang out in your fortress on the Boyne, strumming your harp and dallying with the women of the Celtic tribes, I suppose.
Ah, you have done your research. However, I do have the ability to interact with brainwave patterns. I can sense emotional states, intercept an intent, a form of empathy.
So you're not actually peeking into other minds?
McCann fluttered a dismissive hand through the air.
I receive flashes of insight. For example, I know you are deliberately stalling, optimistically hoping something will happen to avert the next few minutes, much less the next few hours.
He smiled sourly, almost sadly.
You're hoping your friends will stage a miraculous and melodramatic rescue at the proverbial last second.
It's happened before.
Contraindicated by your attitude. But I assure you, it will not happen. You are on the road of fate, trapped in destiny like a fly in amber. I suggest you adopt the fatalism of your companion.
McCann nodded toward Filboid.
He's resigned to it all.
Filboid finally showed some spirit. He glared at McCann through the thick lenses of his glasses.
Thanks to you and Majira's madness, I've had a lot of time to get used to the idea.
McCann regarded him with an expression that was almost sympathetic. His eyes lightened.
If our children had followed our edicts set down so long ago, if they had circumscribed your development, this situation would not have come to pass, and this moment would not exist. Earth, if not a paradise, would at least not still be suffering the effects of your last war. Your kind is paying the price for our own failure, and that is regrettable. However, once the final codicil of the pact is executed, you will be beyond madness.
Bridget stepped to the edge of the disk.
You can put a stop to the madness. It's not too late.
McCann's eyes darkened again.
It's 3 millennia too late.
He made an abrupt, intricate gesture with his left hand near his heart, but there was a bitter mockery to it.
On your way.
The disk hummed softly as it floated them upward. A sinking sensation in Bridget's stomach replaced her nausea, at least temporarily. She heard no mechanical noises from beneath the disk, so she guessed it operated on principles different from the hydraulic piston system used in the admin monoliths.
It's powered by a localized anti-gravity field. These shafts already existed, and we just put them to use for the anti-gravs. Experimental and damn expensive, but what the hell? The government had money to burn. I guess the government and all the money is burned now.
Bridget didn't respond to the comment.
This isn't Danon or Anunnaki technology?
Filboid shook his head, inhaling deeply. He glanced down at the head in his hands and then looked away, his grin molding itself into a mask of revulsion.
I'm starting to believe that everything humanity thought they invented was Danon or Anunnaki technology.
He tittered suddenly. Bridget looked at him, her flesh crawling. The man was teetering on the brink of hysteria, if not a complete psychotic break.
What's so funny?
Filboid tried to stifle another giggle.
What Kane called McCann? Peter Pan. I bet McCann really is Peter Pan. Maybe the guy who wrote that based the story on McCann. He probably met him when he was a kid or something.
Bridget smiled at him wanly.
I suppose that's a possibility, but this isn't Never Never Land.
Filboid swallowed another giggle, a reflex action that looked almost painful.
Fucking A.
Hundreds of feet of smooth, featureless shaft wall went by before the disk bumped to a gentle stop. An oval-topped portal opened before them. Incised into the top of the arch, Bridget saw the cup and spiral glyph. Both people stepped off the disk. At first, there wasn't much to see, just the perfect smoothness of ancient walls with ceiling light panels shedding an electroplasmic illumination. Filboid took several steps forward, then his entire body was racked by a shudder and he came to a halt. He turned pleading eyes to Bridget, hands trembling violently around Majira's head.
Let me get rid of this.
It's not up to me. The decision is yours to make.
Make it for me.
He looked ill, his eyes darting wildly like some frantic animal's. They were fevered, tormented.
I'm sorry, but I can't go through with this. I'm liable to lose it, to go nuts, and be of no use to you. Take your knife and kill me.
Bridget's lips tightened.
No.
Oh, we'll be dead in a few hours anyway. Kill me now, and I won't have to subject myself to this depravity any longer.
Bridget laid a steady hand on the man's quaking shoulder.
Don't go simple on me, Dr. Filboid. If you do, I won't kill you. But I'll make you wish you were dead, at least for a few minutes.
Tears crawled down Filboid's face.
Please!
Bridget slapped him. Not an attention-getting cuff, but an open-handed blow that twisted his head on his neck and sent him stumbling into the wall.
You claim you're a scientist. Prove it.
The man blinked at her, shoulders sagging.
How?
By acting like a rational human being, not a terrified animal. We'll get through this if you use your mind. I'm scared too, but I've been in enough jams like this to have learned that giving in to fear only makes the problem worse.
Filboid nodded, then slowly pushed himself away from the wall. He threw her a shamed, jittery smile.
I've lived with fear for so long, you'd think nothing would bother me now.
Bridget returned his smile with one she hoped was reassuring and understanding.
You never can tell what'll crawl out of your psyche when you're not looking.
Filboid took several deep breaths and started walking. The foyer of the lift shaft opened into a big tunnel of softly gleaming alloy. It was like a rectangle with a triangle on top in cross-section, at least 15 feet across. There were no features, no friezes or glyphs of the type she had seen in the base of the citadel. Filboid wrinkled his nose.
The air is bad up here.
It's thin. We'd better not exert ourselves unless absolutely necessary.
The passageway was only 20 yards long, and it ended in a vast, vaguely lit space. It was closed in by towering walls of black stone that rose to a high arched vault, lost in the darkness overhead. Suspended from the apex of the arch, a single large globe lightened the heavy shadows, but only barely. It was too little light for human optic nerves. Bridget waited at the mouth of the tunnel, looking around the gloom, then took a careful step over the threshold.
Let's take it slow.
You're the boss.
She smiled wryly.
That'll be a novel change.
Then she heard the faint sound of stealthy footfalls, but not from within the passageway. The rapid, scuttering noise did not sound like human footsteps. They stopped for a second, then began again. Bridget sensed Filboid stiffening beside her.
Oh, shit.
Bridget fisted her knife.
What?
The sequence of scuffs and scutters began again, swelling in volume. A pair of crimson orbs stabbed out of the gloom.
Carnabots!
As the mechanoid advanced farther into the light, spilling out from the tunnel, Bridget saw it was only a single Carnabot. But that didn't make her feel any better. Her heart was beating hard and fast in her chest, but she kept her breathing from becoming erratic. The Carnabot extended its head, and its maw opened with a faint whir of servo motors. The alloy-coated teeth looked as vicious as any teeth Bridget had seen on any living creature, mutated or not. But even worse than the teeth were the red photoreceptor eyes. The glow they exuded was almost hypnotic.
It's smelling us, trying to match us up in its fuel data files.
The long segmented neck suddenly retracted into the dull gray body, and the lethal automaton backed away into the shadows.
Why did it retreat?
Filboid shook his head.
I don't know.
Let's ease on out. We better stand back to back, though.
Filboid obeyed, and the two people edged out of the tunnel mouth, taking small steps. The concept of leaving even the feeble illumination of the passageway's light panels caused Bridget's spine to grow cold with dread. No matter which way she looked, she felt certain the Carnabot was creeping up on them from another direction.
Do they act like this often?
Only one of it. Two of us. Maybe a single droid isn't programmed to attack multiple targets. It could be transmitting a signal to bring others here.
Sounds reasonable.
The Carnobot leaped from the shadows, hurtling toward them, head and neck at full extension, jaws gaping wide. Filboid shouted wordlessly and shouldered Bridget aside. He went down under the heavy metal weight amid a crash, a clatter, and wild flailing of legs. Bridget yelled and kicked the robot's rump. Its head swiveled in her direction, and the jaws champed to expose sharp teeth. They were red and wet. Bridget closed the distance in two quick strides. Her hand came down with the knife, driving it deeply into the Carnobot's right eye. The blade split the malevolent crimson of the orb and filled the ruined socket with a brief flash of sparks. She felt it scrape against the back of the droid's skull, and she viciously twisted the blade, hoping to spear through critical circuitry. The Carnobot sprang from Philboyd, and she yanked the blade free. Bridget felt the floor quiver from the Predator's weight, and she turned to run. She heard the clatter of its feet as it hurtled after her. She never glanced over her shoulder. She heard the click of jaws opening and closing, and in a brief, fear-crazed moment, she wondered if she had enraged the thing. The Carnobot leaped, and she reacted instinctively. She fell back on the floor, twisting as she did so. She slammed her open hand against the mechanoid's lower jaw, popping the fangs together. Then she twisted hard in the other direction, driving the knife between the juncture of the robot's neck and its head. The droid came down on her hard, nearly driving all the wind from her lungs and banging the back of her head against the floor. A mixture of oil and synthetic bile sloshed over her shoulder when the Carnobot's heavy head slammed down on it, its jaws closing around it. A shrill yelp escaped her teeth as pain ripped through her shoulder, but its fangs didn't penetrate the fabric of her shadow suit. Bridget struggled against the metal predator's weight, trying to push it off as she twisted the knife between the automaton's neck and skull, widening the hole. Its jaws opened and closed against her stomach, but they lacked the strength to tear open the protective material and the flesh beneath. Lying on top of her, the Carnobot gave a final stem-to-stern shiver and went still. The glow from its single eye went out with the suddenness of a candle flame being extinguished. Breathing rapidly, in big gasps, Bridget elbowed the robot's body aside. It wasn't easy, and afterward she lay on her back for a moment, stunned that she was still alive. Then, heart racing, she forced herself up and into motion. Her knife hand, arm, and shoulder were covered in thick, viscous fluid. She returned swiftly to Philboyd, who lay in a limp, boneless heap. Majira's head had rolled away from him, but his eyes were masked by blood flowing from a deep gash in his forehead, covering the lenses of his glasses with a scarlet film. Kneeling beside him, Bridget removed his glasses, sluicing the blood away from his face.
Philboyd, wake up!
His eyelids fluttered, and his mashed lips stirred. She bent down in order to hear him.
Broke something inside of me. Did you get the damn thing?
I got it.
He tried to grin.
One tough babe. Tell me, are there trees where you're from?
Bridget smiled, but it felt stitched.
Lots of them. You'll get to see them.
Oh, I'd like to. I really would.
She cradled his head in her arms.
Can you stand up?
Liquid scarlet flowed over his lips to mix with the blood already coating his face. His face screwed up in pain.
I'll do my damnedest, but maybe you could ask them for help.
Bridget gazed down at him uncomprehendingly for a moment. Then she swiveled her head so fast her neck tendons twinged in protest. Two of the black-clad, faceless furies loomed out of the murk, light winking dully from the silver spheres tipping their ubalus rods. Frantically, Bridget reached out and snagged Majira's head by the hair. She pulled it to her and held it aloft, turning the ruined features toward the furies. They didn't react, only stood as silent and as motionless as ebony statues. She wondered if Majira's face was so maimed they didn't recognize it.
McCann gives you a last gift and final message. It is time to pay the devil his due.
She enunciated each word clearly and precisely, then she waited for a response. When none was forthcoming, she almost repeated the message, but then the Furies lowered their batons. One stepped forward and extended a hand to Bridget. A hollow voice emanated from the blank face.
Our God has long waited for that message, as we have waited for your gift.